This is Storage Unpacked. Subscribe at storageunpacked.com.
Hi, this is Chris Evans recording a Storage Unpacked podcast this week. I'm here again, as usual, with Martin. How are you doing, Martin?
Hey, Chris, how are you?
Not too bad. Just come back from a week in the US, in Austin. It was incredibly hot. So coming back to the UK was a bit of a shock.
Yeah, it's been nice and warm. Okay, the weather's turned today, but we had a gorgeous weekend. It's not been so bad.
No, true. And for the record, anybody who's listening, our little date mark, today is the first day of autumn.
It is, or fall. Mm.
Or fall, if you're in the Americas. This week we have a guest. Glad to say we're joined by Phil White from Scale Computing. Hi, Phil.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So you are CTO, is that correct?
I am CTO, yes.
And would you like to just spend, 30 seconds letting people know what Scale Computing actually does, and then we can get into the discussion?
Absolutely. So Scale Computing, we have an HCI infrastructure solution, hyperconverged infrastructure solution. It's based on commodity hardware. And what we do is we package together things like distributed, highly available storage and a hypervisor and put it into a nice, simple and easy to use package combined with full orchestration of workloads, just really to sort of minimize the involvement that a system administrator needs with the platform. And the advantage there is that we're able to target market segments that typically have sort of been underserved by some of the larger players just because there might not be a lot of domain expertise in some of those market segments. And by having a product that's extremely easy to use and very cost effective, you know, we've done quite well over the last 10 years with this product. So that's it in a nutshell, really.
Okay, brilliant. Now, for the record, I do actually have one of your systems in my lab. Thank you very much.
Excellent.
I use all the time. I find it, and it is true. It is really simple to use. It is really straightforward. And I'm going to be really sad if it dies and I don't have it to use. But I do enjoy it. It works really well, and it is fun to work with. So
excellent. I'm glad to hear that.
Just that's my little bit of disclosure out the way. Okay. Now, in terms of our conversation today, this is something I think that's come up. Maybe it's quite a few months ago that we were originally talking as part of a release of your product, and I've spoken to Collier a few times, and he's brought up this subject, and that's the idea of edge computing, and then and specifically in your platform, actually putting it out in the edge. And I thought it'd be good to talk about that today, really understand what you mean by that in terms of edge computing, how you see it being deployed, and how, for example, because we're a storage podcast, people are managing their storage at the edge and the core, and how the whole thing sort of holds together. So let's start with edge as a definition. How would you, Phil, define edge computing?
Well, you know, I've defined this in many different ways in the past, and I've sort of settled on one definition, which is, I think, just simple, and that is that edge is compute that is outside of the walls of a traditional data center. And so I like that explanation because it is simple. If you dive into the details a little bit, you know, I think you can add something specific, such as like compute that is specific to one location that's happening at that location for reasons of latency, connectivity, or security. I think those are three big reasons why a particular workload would be necessary to run at the edge as opposed to in a traditional data center or in the cloud. So there are, many environments where that is the case, in particular retail, manufacturing, things like mining. I mean, there are many different use cases for this, but those things are the sort of commonalities across all these use cases that sort of necessitate some kind of compute workload happening sort of in a particular location.
Okay, Martin, just from our perspective, you and I, looking back at our careers, I think we've always had edge computing in one format or another, and I can probably think of a number of examples where, especially in the retail space, we've seen what people would not have classed as edge computing in those days, but is actually still edge computing.
Oh, yeah. But edge computing has been around, well, since year dot in many ways. You could say retail, banking. If you look at banking, arguably the first ATMs were edge computing because they were dealing with things and then they were sending data back. It feels like an evolution of client server.
You're right. So I suppose they could have been autonomous, an ATM.
Yeah.
If the network goes down, they'll still sometimes they would serve money. So yeah, they were autonomous edge computing devices. Who knew? Yeah. I think that's a good definition of a good example of an edge computing device. Phil, I would just add one other thing that I think people have said to me recently, and that's there's a different speed, different velocity, and different type of processing that we would do at the edge. And that just means it isn't necessarily just that those sort of examples we've talked about, but it might be AI or other types of workloads.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And you know, and that gets back to that the latency requirements, right? When you're processing at a certain velocity, for example, you know, your AI example, you're using, say, video analytics, or you're using neural networks to do object recognition in a video stream, you know, that there's a certain velocity of what you're doing there where that operation really makes the most sense at the edge. You know, you don't want to be streaming video up into the cloud to do AI processing in real time, and especially as you get into, say, you know, a large retail store or grocery store that might have hundreds of different cameras, it's just not feasible to expect that you would do any of that sort of AI inferencing anywhere but locally in that location.
I think you just picked a good example out there, actually, talking about retail, because obviously if we were looking back at retail the way it used to be, we might have thought of retail as being tills or systems that are processing credit cards or things like that. But actually, there's a lot more to that now. And it might well be, as you just pointed out, a store could be collecting images from cameras or other sorts of sources of data. It could be, for example, processing footfall or looking at the way that the shop's being utilized in terms of the way people are moving around. So in actual fact, it's possibly as well we're creating new types of data and different types of data that we've not even seen before.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the biggest things that excites me about what's possible with AI and machine learning. The things you can do, or there's the potential of what you can do with data that is already being collected. You know, I think video cameras are a perfect example. There are, people have been using video cameras for ages and just recording to, you know, NVRs or DVRs, the video streams, you know, in case that video is needed for some reason around safety or security or for liability reasons. But when you think about the amount of data that is actually in a recorded video with regards to, safety and security issues, are persons in secure areas after hours, are persons going into hazardous areas where they could be injured, you know, and then you had mentioned, analyzing footfall or traffic flow in and out of different areas. Does that constitute a fire hazard? Could we rearrange aisles in a store to make things flow better, right? And that's all data that is sitting there in those video feeds that is, you know, ripe for analysis. And, you know, I think, the coming years are going to be very interesting to see what sort of software can be developed to do those analysis. And, you know, there are many customers that I've talked to who are already trying to do this thing, but, you know, there's not yet good enough software that's available off the shelf, and people are attempting to, you know, hire developers and develop their own models. And that's, you know, that's a heavy lift today that requires a lot of resources, several employees and developers to dedicated to that task, where I think that in the future, what we'll see is, better off the shelf software to do that sort of thing.
Right. So are you thinking that, is that referring to the ability to actually store and manage the data? Is it front-end applications that people are developing for themselves to allow them to collect this data and aggregate, you know, sources or streams of data that are coming into a platform? What sort of things are you meaning by, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, and I tend to, you know, as a CTO, I tend to have vision about a lot of things that, you know, would be nice and don't always come to fruition just because it's, you know, there's a lot of components that would really have to work together here. But I kind of envision, you know, this concept of a shared data platform where you could have things like video streams and audio streams from microphones, as well as, you know, temperature sensors, you know, door and window sensors and things like that, where all of the data can be gathered together, whether it's applications use that directly, or we can summarize that data and, you know, data scientists can do analysis on that and come up with models and neural networks trained to identify situations that a human might not even be able to sort of infer, right? Where you have connections between different sets of data that might help you make better business decisions, but won't necessarily be obvious to a human.
Okay, so let's talk about the idea of how on earth we would even go about deploying the technology to make this sort of stuff work. Now, clearly, you've got a number of large customers who are I think I know at least one retail customer you've had that's rolling out infrastructure into all of their retail stores. But that's what sort of challenges are we seeing in terms of how to put that technology out into the wild? You know, I would obviously guess that data center facilities would be an issue and probably local skills. But, you know, what else do you see in the wild, shall we say?
Yeah, there are several issues, you know, and several challenges. One of them being, you know, traditional and legacy applications and, you know, the need to sort of consolidate and which really makes a lot of sense, right? I mean, when you're talking about rolling out to thousands and thousands of locations, cost effectiveness is extremely important. You don't want to run different servers for different tasks. You don't want to have a separate DVR gathering video feeds. You don't want to have a separate system running your point of sale system. You don't want a separate system yet again running your HVAC system or doing your temperature monitoring of your fridges in the grocery store. You want a converged system that allows all of those workloads to run together. And, you know, whether that is a modern ML application that might be running in containers, or if it's a sort of legacy customer loyalty application that requires, that it's effectively a Windows application, right, that requires a Windows VM running, you know, in the store, you want to run all those things on the same platform, which is why, you know, HCI makes so much sense in these environments. So, you know, the challenge being, in order to stay cost effective, you don't want to oversize the platform, right? When you look at what workloads are running in a grocery store, I mean, you could probably count the number of VMs you need on one hand, right? I mean, this is a real small workload overall. And you look at the memory requirements that you need for that, they're relatively modest, right? But then you look at, you know, some of the larger virtualization vendors and what their base requirements are to even run, you know, a highly available storage solution on a multi-node cluster. I mean, it eclipses the entire workload that we're talking about here already, right? So how can you be cost effective when you're deploying those sorts of things, right? And I think that's what's important to realize, is that when you're deploying 10,000 locations or 20,000 locations, every dollar counts at each one of those locations. And you do not want to oversize, because it's going to cost you. So,
I'm guessing to a certain extent that especially if stores are not necessarily, or any location doesn't necessarily have the same volume of data or compute or generates the same amount of traffic, then you're not going to necessarily size for the high watermark and ship everybody the same platform.
That's
right. You want the ability to scale up somehow by adding nodes or doing something. So hence the whole reason why HCI would fit that model quite nicely.
Absolutely. And then when you take into account, you know, what we just talked about with ML and AI, say you just want to run all your existing workloads today, you can start with, you know, say a 3-node cluster to give you the high availability, you know, and size it right for the workload you have today, but then be able to add a different node that might have a GPU in it that would let you do some inferencing at the edge with future applications, right? And be able to just add that to the cluster without having to forklift the whole thing out and start over again. You know, that's really important in terms of cost effectiveness.
Yeah, Martin, I would have said from my perspective, and I've done it at least one location, done remote management of systems, and this was data protection, actually, funny enough, and a bit of NetApp, and actually a bit of virtualization. So, in fact, it was a bit of everything. But looking at that sort of technology, trying to manage that remotely is actually fairly tricky to get right, because you did want that standardization. I don't know whether you have any edge sort of requirements yourself, but you must have come across this before.
Well, we do. We stick things in trucks. So
okay. That's true. Yeah.
You think about outside broadcast, those trucks will be full of compute of various sorts, whether they're on site edit suites or stuff to ship things back. Yeah. So it happens all the time, and that needs to be as simple to manage and maintain as possible. Obviously, it comes back to the center on a fairly regular basis. But even from fixing things, if you look at a typical OB engineer, outside broadcast engineer, they're multi-skilled, but they do want these things to be simple. They want to be able to pull things in and out of quickly. They need to be able to fix things. And yeah, if you find yourself an event where you might need some extra grunt, you want something which you can just add into a truck very quickly.
Yeah, good point. I hadn't thought of that, but you're right. And I guess one of the things there, and this will lead into, I guess, Phil explaining how they manage it, but you must have an issue there with data, because you're streaming back tons of data. So are you relying on satellite as an uplink to get your data back?
some places. If you think sport, most sports events, if you take something like F1, F1 has an incredible network infrastructure these days, so you're not really worried about streaming data back. Football grounds, all the football grounds in the UK have certainly all the Premiership grounds, but they have very good infrastructure. You can just plug into a fibre network of some sort. But yeah, but then when you start talking about remote news gathering, but then again, a lot of remote news gathering these days is done on a is actually done on that edge computing device known as a phone.
Yeah, good point. Good point. So, funny enough, last week when I was out in the US, I actually chatted to the guy who runs Mercedes, the Mercedes team's IT.
Yeah.
And one of the things that they highlight is the fact that they would love to be able to just ship empty systems and download the data across the network, but the network cost comes out to be one of the most expensive parts for them, especially in some of the more exotic locations where they can't get the bandwidth without a huge amount of cost. So they end up just picking the stuff up and carrying it around, which sounds a bit odd. But Phil, just from your perspective, in that sort of core edge design in terms of trying to manage how you synchronize data, back it up, copy it and so on, what do you see out in the wild in terms of how difficult that problem really is to address?
Yeah, so that is a challenge. And, you know, typically with an initial deployment, you know, the way that it's done is the cluster would first be sort of populated with, you know, gold masters or whatnot, you know, in your central location. And then the cluster would just be shipped as one piece pre-assembled and configured into the location that it's installed in, you know, whether that's a grocery store or a quick service restaurant, whatever. So that way, when it comes up, you know, it's ready to go. There's a set of images that are there, and then you can use something such as Ansible or Terraform from a central location to sort of push out your configuration for each location, right? You can put together sort of a central inventory of all your different locations, different applications and whatnot that might be running in each location, and then automate that deployment. And that includes things like upgrades as well, and, you know, other operational changes that you might make as part of your fleet management, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's infrastructure, isn't it? So you're talking about being able to push VMs out and do other things. Mm-hmm. What about actual end user data? I mean, that strikes me as probably one of the hardest things to keep in sync and protect and so on.
Yeah, you know, and honestly, that a lot of that comes down to the applications that are used. You know, in the case of, you know, with point of sale systems and inventory tracking and things like that, you know, those applications are responsible for syncing their own data back to a central data center, which actually has the nice side effect of meaning that, you know, redeploying a particular location is quite easy because there's a lot less state stored in that location. In many cases, if something were to go wrong at that location, it'd be trivial to just sort of, you know, blow away and redeploy the entire infrastructure for that location and start over because those applications are doing that. Now, that being said, there are applications that are not built that way and that essentially run standalone in that location. And, you know, that requires you to then do some sort of replication back to a data center or into a cloud. You know, in many cases, like, you know, in our product's case, for one thing, you know, we have those sort of features built in, right, for either cloud DR, or if you have a second location or a data center, you can do asynchronous block tracking and send the blocks back to the data center, and such that if you have, you know, some sort of scenario where you need to either fail over or redeploy that VM, you at least have, you know, some sort of an older version of that VM you can bring back down. So
Phil, as we look at an environment that might be a few thousand nodes, I guess that's semi-easy to manage. I say semi-easy, it sounds really easy. It sounds like I'm making it sound trivial. But if you started to get into tens of thousands of edge devices, and in some cases, there's no reason why you couldn't have tens of thousands of edge systems in terms of, you know, your platform, for sake of argument, that's really going to put you into a difficult position in terms of management.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, the automatic handling of failures and, you know, things like drive failures and node failures becomes very important. You know, and this is one of the things that our product had incorporated early on, you know, really just due to the market we were focused on. And, you know, drive failures and node failures need to be non-emergencies, essentially, right? This is even more important if you have 10,000 locations. If a drive fails or you have some sort of a failure, you can't require someone to immediately have to come visit that site. Our largest customer which is the grocery store chain, I think that you mentioned, their strategy for solving this problem is to have tech staff that is scheduled to visit each location every 90 to 180 days. And what that means is if a failure occurs the day after that person is there, that system must continue to function in, you know, with full redundancy and highly available for the remainder of that time. So having a product that's designed to do that in an automated way is extremely important, right? If a drive fails, redundancy needs to be restored and the system needs to continue on at, you know, a reduced capacity, of course, but assuming capacity is sized correctly, that should not be a problem.
So that makes me immediately start to get a bit nervous to think that somebody might not be going back to a location for another 6 months. That sort of like double failure thing comes to mind immediately. However, I imagine that if you do it right and you understand how to escalate a problem, so for instance, you know, if you tag a disk failure as being a standard thing that happens every so often, you possibly wouldn't need to make an emergency for that or create a special trip. Whereas if something else happens, like you'd had a double disk failure or you've had some other sort of failure, there might be some reason why you escalate, a reason to push that site a bit closer to the front in terms of having another visit.
That's right. Yeah. And you know, drive failures are certainly bad. You know, and you're exposed momentarily while that system is then rebuilding its redundancy, right? And then after that time window is up, which, you know, depending on the sizing of a cluster, it could take anywhere from minutes to say an hour or 2 hours, something like that. Once that time is over and the system has been fully restored, you're fine to experience another drive failure. It puts you just in the same situation, right? Your capacity reduces with each drive failure, but those are not emergencies, right? Now, in a situation where let's say you have a node failure, now you have one node that's offline. Yeah, that's worse, right? You definitely escalate that in terms of priority. If you start having additional failures, then yeah, perhaps you need to escalate that to be more of an emergency and actually send somebody to that location. But, you know, in the normal mode of operation, you know, where drive failures are really the common thing, you know, that's less of an emergency, certainly. And you're only exposed for a brief amount of time in those situations. And then on top of that, you know, the monitoring tools that I think really help you out are important as well. You know, one of the first things we learned with these large deployments is that it's key to sort of visualize these problems and be able to view in like essentially a single pane of glass, you know, what are the critical issues among my entire fleet. And so, you know, we actually developed the tools to do just this for our first large grocer customer, because this was the real problem that they faced, right? Is how do you determine and how do you prioritize where the real problems are?
And that's exactly what I was going to ask you, because it seems to me like you would have to completely change your way of visualizing systems compared to maybe the way you would have done it if you were sitting in a data center, perhaps. And it takes something from the network management field, perhaps, I don't know. But, you know, you'd expect they would have similar challenges to deal with.
Yeah, and the way you can think about it is, you know, it's similar to like, you know, tools like Splunk or, you know, other sort of aggregated monitoring tools, you know, whether you're using SNMP or those sorts of things kind of solve a similar problem. You know, but given the fact that our product had already, you know, when you look at a single cluster, had that sort of technology built in to kind of identify where you have real problems and which problems are not necessarily as bad. You know, we can kind of integrate with that technology directly and view it at, you know, at scale, like view it at, you know, the 1,000 to 10,000 sites in a single monitoring console.
You talk about retail. At least retail's is that actually on the shore? I mean, way back in the past, I was involved in putting systems on boats and oil rigs. So yet again, it's not especially new. We've been dealing with remote systems for a long time. And if you have a seismic processing system sitting on a boat, which is down in the South Atlantic, you'll start monitoring, you'll be looking for failures, you'll be looking at redundancy, because it's very expensive either to get an engineer back onto a boat if something goes wrong or for it to come out on port. But it's also, they don't want to lose that time, because it's, even then, it's still very expensive to have a ship in the middle of the ocean trying to process and find oil. They want to be processing in real time so they know where they target their next piece of science to make work. So it's a slightly smaller problem if you've got a boat, but it's much more complicated because you've got that latency of getting an engineer there. I suspect what we're seeing is lots of these remote processing, learning from some of the more extreme industries which we have around.
So we're going to see a lot more of this logistics type thinking, I guess, in order to be able to work out how on earth. And then I'm not talking about necessarily, you know, edge clusters or nodes. It could be all sorts of devices and other things, but trying to monitor them, understand where what state they're in, and work out a decent schedule where you can actually most efficiently go and manage them without having to turn up or have thousands of staff going around trying to support that sort of environment. And it sounds, from what you're saying, Phil, this is the sort of stuff you've already built.
Absolutely. Yeah, we have, Martin, as you described, you know, we have customers doing exactly that, right? We have clusters on oil rigs. We have clusters in mining areas where, you know, there is no internet access, and, you know, getting information in and out is quite challenging and very logistically expensive. And having a system that can, you know, is designed to continue to operate and make some basic decisions on its own to automatically resolve failures and sort of delay the required maintenance as a result. You know, it's very important in those environments.
I'm still not 100% convinced. I really have got my head around some of the data challenges in this, in terms of either backup or synchronization, especially if you're collecting data that you want to put into a large repository for ML AI. Now, do we think, Phil, that the public cloud is part of the solution here, where, you know, the fact that we potentially have access points around the world, or at least we've got the ability to dump data into object stores and so on, and maybe then pick it up from there? What are you seeing in customers using cloud in that way at all?
I haven't seen much of that yet, but I think that there is a lot of potential there. You know, in particular, you know, when I look at the cloud, I see the advantage in the sort of elasticity of the resources that are there. And if, you know, depending on your application, if you are collecting data and you need to train models periodically, I think the public cloud is perfect for that particular process, right? Where you are bringing your data into the cloud and you want to improve the models you're using at the edge, the cloud is the place to do that. But that certainly does, as you brought up, pose some challenges as far as getting the data there, especially when you have environments like we've been describing that are remote, that may not have internet or may not have fast enough internet. The amount of data being collected is, you know, there's just no way you can get it into the cloud. You know, the amount of data being collected in a mine is mind-boggling. And yeah, there is just basically no way to get that data into the cloud. So, you know, in some of those cases, perhaps training at the edge makes sense. But, you know, I think in the more common cases where internet is available, yes, some of that data needs to be brought into the cloud to improve the models. As to what data needs to go in, you know, I'm not really a data scientist. So I'm not going to claim to know that or what the best approach there is. But, you know, there's definitely some trade-offs that are going to have to happen, because you can't bring it all in, but no. You know, it some of it needs to get there, and you need to, the right data needs to be there, and you know, and then you can take advantage of what the cloud has to offer in elasticity and modern hardware and modern you know, GPUs and whatnot. So
yeah, Martin, from your perspective, I mean, we've talked about this before many times, haven't we? Public cloud and where we think we might end up, whether we'd see it all head to the public cloud or not.
We feel, but a lot of this will end up in the public cloud. You'll do a certain amount on the edge, and then you'll push data back. If we're thinking about things like retail stores where you have thousands of stores and you want to carry out ML on a data set, well, obviously the power will be, there'll be the local processing, but also bringing that all back into the center is going to be absolutely key, because you want to be using the largest possible data set at times to identify what decisions you should make, from stocking to footfall, understanding why one store is different to another store. It's going to be a combination. We're going to carry on seeing edge computing. We're going to carry on seeing computing in the center. It could be public cloud, it could still be a private cloud if people so wish. But edge computing feels like just an evolution of where we've been for some time.
Yeah, I think on scenarios like you've just said, and imagine that store scenario where you're trying to train models to do something like, you know, analyze footfall or whatever, to a certain degree, you can't rely on just doing that analysis of one store alone, because you might need the collection of all of those stores to get enough data in order to actually do some sort of analysis. So there's going to be some data movement in order to achieve this, but we're also going to have to work out that we're not trying to reread the same data, or we're, you know, we've not got data that we've missed. So there's got to be some sort of ability to keep track of everything. And I think that's going to be a bigger challenge as anything. But it sounds like we're saying public cloud is going to be a big part of this. So from your perspective, Phil, how does the public cloud fit in with the sort of architectures you see people develop?
That's a good question. You know, I think that it will come down to the applications. I mean, as a platform guy, you know, it's easy to kind of think about how that sort of thing might work, but really that's up to the applications and how they end up utilizing the data and you know, how much of the data they need is really going to be up to them. Like the examples we were just talking about, footfall in stores, like, you know, it really is going to be the developers who are building those models that need to decide how you pick the optimal video to upload, right, from each location, and how you do that analysis. You know, and I think that utilizing the public cloud will likely make sense from a customer's perspective, because, you know, the training is not going to be something that you're going to be constantly running. You will run it from time to time. And I really think that, you know, the elasticity again of the public cloud will let you be more cost effective doing that. But again, you know, I don't claim to be an expert in that field.
You're played in the fifth.
Yeah, precisely.
No, but you know, it's fair enough. You know, you're putting in the infrastructure, you're putting that layer in there. You're the enabling, the enabling underpinning to people being able to put the applications on top. And it does still require you to, as you said, address those issues of scale, of flexibility, efficiency, and being able to actually deploy infrastructure out there that isn't going to require tons and tons of manpower in order to support. So I think if those bits aren't right in the first place, then you can't do the rest afterwards.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, well, that was a great discussion, Phil. Thank you for your time. If people would like to go and find more about Scale Computing, other than obviously scalecomputing.com as the website, can they follow you online? You know, is there a Twitter handle for the company? Where should we send them?
There are both options, actually. You can follow me online at Real Phil White, and I believe Scale Computing also has a Twitter account at Scale Computing. So
fantastic,
fairly straightforward.
So if you want to know more, off you go there. Okay. Well, Phil, Martin, thanks for your time again, and look forward to catching up with you soon.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Martin.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked, or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.